From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Political games still holding up help for Flint.
There is such a disconnect in so many levels of government between the people out there who are paying the bills, trying to raise their family, go to work each day, and the people that they've elected.
The State House clears a Detroit school aid bill that comes down mighty hard on the teachers and their union.
This action on the teachers has been characterized by Republicans as being the adults in the schoolyard. But some people are asking the question, they're being the adults or they're being the bully?
Plus, want us to really care about climate change? Then don't load us up with too much science.
The more you get into something in terms of its technical dimensions, the less we begin to care about kind of the human impacts and sort of the pieces of the puzzle that we should feel some empathy towards.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for joining us today. Today, political games still holding up the help that Flint needs.
This is clearly a situation where you're not going to see public officials walk away from this and say, oh, sorry, we made a mistake. Too bad you lose.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes will be here to recap President Obama's visit to Flint and the residents' response to Governor Snyder. But first, it took 15 long hours and an all-nighter. But the State House finally managed to approve a package of six bills aimed at fixing the Detroit public schools. And boy, was that vote along partisan lines. Let's talk about why and how the House and Senate have different views about how to keep DPS doors open. As we say hello to Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. Rick, why did it take more than 15 hours to get this thing approved? Why an all-nighter?
Well, put shortly, there weren't enough votes for it, that the Republican majority that came up with this plan wasn't able to get enough votes in its own caucus to clear it until early in the morning. You know, it was always the intent that this be a bipartisan approach, that it be done with the support of Republicans and Democrats, especially Democrats from Detroit, in order to get this done. And what the Democrats said was, I'll basically put it into three categories. There are a lot of things, but not enough money and not enough things to actually fix the schools. It was very punitive on teachers and the teachers union in Detroit because Republicans are angry about the sick out. And I think this is the big sticking point, what to do about charter schools in the city of Detroit, and in particular, the Detroit Education Commission, that this commission that would have the power to close schools that are falling short, whether those schools be traditional public schools or charter schools. And the charter school operators have a lot of problems with this, and Republicans have a lot of problems with this because the way they want charter schools to work is they want them to be opened and closed based on the marketplace, based on parents and families voting with their feet to either go in or check out.
Yeah, we had Representative Brian Banks, Democrat from Detroit. He says, quote, these bills are anti-student, anti-union, anti-teacher, and anti-democratic. So some of just the words of Democrats railing around at another Democrat, State Representative Andy Shore, a long message on his Facebook page bemoaning not just, you know, what's in this bill, but how it was passed. Something Michiganders are seeing here, you know, that these late night sessions, the Republican Speaker of the House, Cotter, desperately trying to keep
wrangle.
People exactly to wrangle. And it's something that Rick and I have talked a lot about. I think there was some surprise that it actually did pass overnight because earlier in the day, I think folks thought that the votes were not there, a late night session.
Why didn't they send it? We're hearing pretty widely, didn't send enough money. I know Brian Banks said, if we send anything less than $715 million, we're not doing the right thing. This sends, what, $500 million?
Yeah, this sends $500 million, and House Republicans say that covers exactly the Detroit school's current deficit, although, you know, the emergency manager, Judge Rhodes, says that it's really is maybe as high as $800 million.
That's what Rhodes has been saying, closer to $800. And of course, one of the things that we've talked about that I find so interesting is, you know, where this money is coming, the proposed funding from the state tobacco settlement revenue money. Just another example of how budgets have been crafted recently compared to when Governor Snyder first took office, which was this idea of no more smoke and mirrors. You know, we raise the money
no
for this.
No more gimmicks, one-time money.
Yeah. Right. Right. And tobacco settlement money, it just reeks of you know, during the Great Recession when Granholm would, you know, kind of, I will say, budget gimmicks in order to kind of move money over here to make up for this and move it over here. So that's just an interesting thing to watch,
well,
too.
Well, the tobacco settlement money has always been Michigan's pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Well,
that,
but
when
that's
there's something you want to do, there's tobacco settlement.
And that's what I'm saying. The fact that it's coming up here is just this example of, oh, okay, what are we going to do? Oh, look to the tobacco settlement money.
I do want to get your thoughts on some of these actions aimed at the Detroit Federation of Teachers. For example, allowing uncertified teachers to teach in the Detroit public schools.
Collective bargaining changes. Yeah, and look, and I think a lot of—
This is basically House Republicans going out there to try and gut the union, you know, with the excuse being retribution for the sick-outs.
For the sick-outs this week, and I think that's what they were saying. And we heard Gideon DeSandro tell Rick Pluta earlier this week, you know, the sick-outs did not help. And so probably another reason that Speaker Cotter decided to keep Republicans overnight was the timing of all of this kind of turned into this perfect storm.
This action on the teachers has been characterized by Republicans as these legislators being the adults in the schoolyard in the face of this childish behavior. But some people are asking the question, they're being the adults or they're being the bullies?
And we know that the Senate has its version. And I saw on Twitter Senator David Kinesic and Senator Jeff Hansen tweeted pictures of themselves there all night long. Mm-hmm. I guess what? Trying to get the House to move closer to the Senate version and apparently failing, right?
Right. Well, the Senate version is an actual bipartisan approach that it has Republicans and Democrats and Detroit Democrats on board. And really, you know, the House proposal should probably be characterized less as a plan and more as a bargaining position, especially when it comes to charter schools, because now, as the Senate prepares to deal with this, the question becomes, okay, well, what are both sides willing to give up in order, you know, come to a conclusion that can get enough votes to pass?
All right, Rick, now what?
Well, because a lot of these bills were initially adopted in the House, there's a rule in the state constitution that says the Senate cannot vote on them for at least 5 days. And so, you know, the Senate will come back. They'll start unpacking it and looking at it and trying to figure out what's in it. This moved very quickly. Even during the House committee hearing on this, Senate members were coming in going like, well, we don't have the Snyder administration saying, well, we don't have a position on it because we don't know what's in it yet. Mm-hmm. Well, now they're going to figure out what's really in it, and then they're going to figure out what they can live with and what they'll try to bargain away.
The aftermath of the big all-nighter in the State House with our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. As always, thanks you two.
Thanks,
always
Cindy.
A pleasure.
When you think of Cuban exports, you probably think cigars, sugar, and rum. But Cuba exports something of a much greater value to third world countries. Physicians trained for free at the Latin American School of Medicine near Havana. In 2001, Cuba opened the school to Americans. As part of Michigan Radio's Pure Cuba series, Tracy Samilton met a Detroiter who is finally realizing her dream of becoming a physician.
Samantha Moore has absolutely no reason to be this cheerful and energetic when I meet her inside Salvador Allende Hospital in Havana. She's just off a more than 24-hour shift on her surgery rotation.
There were so many cases last night for surgery alone, so we got swamped. I was in an operation at 5 o'clock this morning. Una appendicitis.
In English, that's appendicitis. Moore gives me a tour of the hospital. If you overlook the dated building, it's not that different from the U.S. I see waiting rooms, busy hallways, doctors in scrubs, people going outside to smoke. What's different is the layout. There are lots of open-air hallways and courtyards.
As you can see, everything is open and airy.
Thank goodness for that.
It gets hot.
Yeah.
It gets hot.
Moore rates her education here highly. Her textbooks are the same as those in American medical schools. She has a lot of interaction with patients. In her fourth year, her class went door to door for several weeks, teaching Havana residents how to protect themselves from dengue and Zika. She's assisted in many procedures.
I've got to see hip surgeries, knee surgeries, and I can cast you. I know how to do the casting and everything. It's one of my favorites. It is. I like putting people in casts.
We sit under the shade of gigantic trees on the campus, and Moore tells me her life story. Her path to medical school wasn't linear. She got a bachelor's degree in math and computer science at the University of Detroit Mercy and a master's in computer science at Lawrence Tech. She worked.
It wasn't that I didn't want to go to medical school. I couldn't afford to go to medical school.
Then, one day, she got a call from her dad with news.
You can become a doctor if you want to.
He'd read about the Latin American School of Medicine in the Michigan Chronicle. He urged her to apply, and he kept urging her until she did.
You'll be bilingual, and you'll be a doctor. You have nothing to lose. And it's free.
With the average medical school debt in the U.S. about $180,000, free had a good ring to it. She was accepted in the program and 7 years later has no regrets. As to the weakness she sees in the Cuban medical system.
The weakness is financial.
Not surprising, given the Cuban government's limited budget. And Moore says the U.S. embargo doesn't help. Say a hospital in Cuba acquires a U.S.-made MRI or other machine and it breaks down, it can mean long waits for patients who need tests.
They eventually find parts, but it's not something that they can fix, like, right away. Where in the U.S. is like, oh, we need this part, we can special order it, have it there in the afternoon or the very next day.
The main goal of the Latin American School of Medicine is training doctors to serve impoverished and underserved people in their home countries. Moore wants to do that as either a family physician or an internal medicine doctor.
I would like to do it in Michigan. I really would like to stay in Michigan and do my residency, so I'm hoping for that.
She'll graduate in June. Like all doctors in the U.S., she'll have to run the gauntlet of passing her exams and being matched with a hospital for her residency years. I'm Tracy Samilton, Michigan Radio News.
Our thanks to Mercedes Mejia, who also contributed to this story. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What does it take to make us care, really care, about climate change? That's what University of Michigan researchers explored in a study that's been published in Nature Climate Change. What they found seems to refute that line of thinking that culture is the biggest factor in whether we care and are willing to do something about climate change. Joe Arvai is the Max McGraw Professor of Sustainable Enterprise at the School of Natural Resources and Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. Joe also directs the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise. It's good to have you with us, Joe.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
What were you seeking to learn in this study?
There's been a lot of research that's come out recently, as you pointed out, that suggests that culture is a real big driver of how much people care about climate change and how much they're willing to act. And there was something very puzzling about the findings. And the puzzling piece was that how much you knew about climate change seemed to be disconnected from how much you cared. So we wanted to look quite deeply into how people were measuring knowledge and to really look to see if it was being measured in a way that kind of made sense given the context of climate change. And then if we could do a better job, how would it stack up against how we think culture ought to inform concern?
How did your study approach this question differently?
The previous research on this subject, which is actually very good and very interesting, did two things. It didn't really measure in-depth knowledge about climate change. What it really measured was general scientific literacy in kind of a broad sense. Mm. That was number one. Number two was when they looked at culture, they were really looking at U.S.-based political ideologies. Culture, as we all know, is quite broad. It encompasses different countries. It encompasses different values and worldviews. And we wanted to see if we could find a way to capture that as well. So in our study, we looked at very specific knowledge about climate change across three different dimensions, and then we looked at culture across a variety of dimensions and across six different countries, and then used that information to see how concern about climate change materialized.
What did you find? How does that concern materialize?
Knowledge plays a very large role in how much we care about climate change and how much we're willing to act. Specifically, two aspects of knowledge stood out. One was knowledge about the causes of climate change, what we're doing as human beings to create the problem, and the consequences of climate change, both for people and the environment. What we found didn't play a role in driving concern about climate change was sort of biophysical knowledge about climate change, the technical details about sort of the mechanics of climate change, how it works, why it works the way it works. That seemed to actually dampen concern and willingness thing is to act on climate change. The more you get into something in terms of its technical dimensions, the less we begin to care about kind of the human impacts and sort of the pieces of the puzzle that we should feel some empathy towards. So it almost desensitizes us to the magnitude of the problem.
But the kind of knowledge that you said works is the kind that strikes me that appeals to us as people because it talks about what we as people do and also what's in it for me when you talk about the consequences.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, I think that's important because as we think about educating people about climate change and when we look at a lot of the debates about climate change, so much of it is focused on sort of the scientific minutiae, which is fantastic and interesting to study.
If you're a climate scientist.
I would think so, yeah. But it's not the thing that we found in terms of our large public samples that seemed to drive concern.
What's wrong with focusing on that cultural side? Is it because we just figure you can't move that mountain and I just have to go with the flow? I as an individual, can't change the cultural whatever it is?
That's part of it for me anyway. And, you know, my opinion on this is that, and our research bears this out, that culture does play a role. Let's not say that it doesn't. How we think about the world in terms of our worldviews, in terms of our values, clearly affects how much we care about things, including climate change. But there's, to me anyway, there's a piece of it that's kind of hopeless. You know, we look at culture as something that changes very slowly. We look at it in terms of, well, we'll just wait for millennials to come on board and start making decisions and the world will get better. But millennials aren't going to be in that position for some 5, 10, 15 years from now. For me to sit back as a policy analyst and as a researcher and wait for culture to sort of evolve, it just doesn't do it for me. I'm looking for ways to move the needle quickly and more impactfully.
And how does the often rancorous political debate we see in this country, there's that kind of perception that Democrats care, Republicans don't about climate change, which is broad strokes and inaccurate, but it causes that churning and that sense of, I can't do anything about this. So how is that playing into this?
You know, the left-right political divide certainly plays a huge role in how we think about climate change and also in terms of how governments and the private sector are acting on climate change. What I see happening, and this is what the cultural researchers do show in their work on this field called cultural cognition, is that the left-right political divide is something that you wear as a badge of honor and you really kind of bend your decisions around how you think you ought to behave given that sort of political ideology that you ascribe to. Knowledge is the thin end of the wedge here. If we really want to get the political parties and the different perspectives in society working on this, it needs to be more than culture and it even needs to be more than knowledge. What we need is what I term active decision support. And some of our other work, what we're finding is if you actually walk people through a complex problem by decomposing it into cognitively manageable parts, people are willing to take off that cultural badge of honor and they're willing to make decisions in line with their values and their priorities, divorced from how they think they should decide based on what their political ideology sort of informs them. So I think what we're seeing in government, we're seeing in the private sector is the needle beginning to kind of tremble a little bit. It's not quite moving yet. And I think it'll start moving when governments, when businesses, when the private sector start looking at building capacity in the area of this sort of active decision support that gets people to think beyond these cultural badges of honor and even beyond what knowledge begins to sort of get them thinking about.
But it gets us back to where you started, which is caring. You can't start moving the needle until people really care and become emotionally invested.
And this is why I really think this study that I was lucky enough to work on with colleagues at ETH Zurich is really important. It suggests that there is hope out there in terms of getting people to care, in terms of getting people's attention. And I think if we can just begin to do that and then couple that with some of the other strategies that we work on, you know, I think we can begin to make a difference.
Let's talk about real-world implications of your work in this study. First, for climate scientists, what are you saying to them as they try to impart the message of that climate change is here and here's what it means?
I think it's important that the science that gets done that connects climate change to people begin using metrics of impact that actually align with the things that people care about. I think what we see is crosstalk between the scientific community and the public and decision makers, where decision makers say, these are the things that we care about. These are our objectives in terms of the decisions that we need to make. And this is how we measure success and failure according to those objectives. We have this wonderful work being done that pumps out this rich body of information every day. But They don't connect. They don't match up. So people are seeing this information coming in. It's highly statistical often. It's highly technical. And people fail to see how that connects with the things that they actually care about. So my advice is ask people, you know, what is it that you care about? How do you measure success and failure when it comes to the impacts of climate change? And what can we do as a scientific community that actually fills that gap with new science, new knowledge that addresses the things that you care about?
What is your sense of the things that the public really does care about? What moves the needle for people?
You know, I think it comes down to three dimensions. One is environmental, as we all might expect. People are relatively compassionate and, you know, very empathetic about environmental concerns. So we certainly want to speak to those kinds of considerations. But as the UN is pointing out to us with their goals for sustainable development, people think about sustainability also in terms of social metrics and also in terms of economic metrics. So we need to think about how we can secure our economic systems, build infrastructure and maintain infrastructure in ways that is both viable in the long term and also resilient to all kinds of global change, including climate change. And then on the social side, people care about poverty, health, you know, security, the kinds of things that, you know, keep parents up in the evening. I don't see enough climate research really addressing those kinds of considerations. I was at a wonderful meeting in Washington, a woman from the State Department, Alice Hill, who was talking about climate change being the biggest national security consideration of our time. And to hear someone from the State Department come out and make a statement like that, you prick up your ears. It makes you think. And then you look at the data and you don't see national security really reflected in there that often. If we want to begin to get people who are on different sides of the political divide to talk to one another, I think we need to do a better job of bringing in this myriad of concerns, the things that people care about.
Talk to their hearts.
Yeah, I guess so.
Joe Arvai is the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment and Ross School of Business, and also the director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise. Thanks for sharing your work and your research with us, Joe.
I was delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Vision.
The next idea.
What they have helped us do is to really think in a totally different way about how to deliver and create something new.
An answer to one of agriculture's most persistent and vexing problems might just be dripping from spider fangs. At least one West Michigan company thinks so. Toxic pesticides have long been a challenge in our food system. They're one of the main motivations behind the massive organic food movement, with more and more people wanting to eat food that can't potentially harm them or the environment. The worldwide search for a natural pesticide that's effective enough so farmers can still make a profit, yet safe enough so our bodies and land don't become contaminated, has largely turned up empty. But Vestaron, a Kalamazoo startup, may have found the solution: spider venom. John Sorensen is the director and the CEO of Vestaron. It's a spinoff from the University of Connecticut that was recruited to Kalamazoo 9 years ago. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Great to be here.
John, what was the essential problem that this research at UConn was digging into?
Well, it was actually a broad program that was looking at spider venoms for inoculation and anti-venoms and all that sort of stuff. And the idea came up one day that these things might have a good insecticidal activity. After all, spiders through the millennia have become pretty good at killing insects. If they don't kill insects, they don't eat. And so the idea occurred to the University of Connecticut researchers to explore whether components of this venom would that didn't have any toxic effects on humans would, in fact, be good insecticides to use.
Now, we know biological insecticides are a whole lot safer than agricultural chemicals, but they haven't been as effective. So is this then a way of coming up with a biological insecticide that will work better than what we've had?
That's precisely correct. The biological insecticides are great because of their non-toxic profile to humans and animals and the environment and so forth, but they just don't work as well. If synthetic insecticides of the kind that have been used for the last 50 years kill insects at about 100% rate or 95% rate, biologicals are more in the range of 80%. And that difference in the effectiveness is just more than good commercial growers can tolerate and still make a profit.
Well, using spider venom, then what's the effectiveness of what you've developed, Spear?
It's exactly the same as the nasty old organic chemicals that have been used for years, 95 to 100% control.
Hmm. And now you don't even need to actually buy spider venom, right? Have you actually been able to figure out how to synthetically make it?
Yes, spider venom is a complex cocktail of about 1,000 different peptides or so, some of which have mammalian effects and many of which don't. And we selected those that don't have any mammalian effects. And we isolated those components, synthesized the genes for them, put them into yeast, and by fermentation, that produces our product for us. So it's a slick way to get around to having to milk spiders.
And I'm sure it's going to be self-generating. And what was it like getting government approval? Did you have to get EPA and FDA approval?
Yes, we had to get EPA approval. We don't have to get FDA approval. And we've gotten that. It took about two-plus years to get it. But we're all signed, sealed, and delivered.
Now, you say it's going to be coming out onto the market by next year?
Yeah, that's correct.
And will this be for large growers, or is actually this a product that the home gardener or the small farming operation can use as well?
Well, it will be for both. And we'll target large growers initially. In fact, our first product will be for the greenhouse, commercial greenhouses that raise both bedding plants and the kind of stuff that you purchase from Lowe's or Home Depot's, and then also vegetable produce, so tomatoes and peppers and cucumbers and those sorts of things that are produced in greenhouses. And there are a team of three pests that are just deadly for greenhouses, thrips and whiteflies and spider mites. And in contrast to even the synthetic chemicals that are out there, we control all three. And so we're really excited about this product.
Now, how has being in Michigan and being in Kalamazoo, how has that been a factor in the company's progress and success to date?
It's really worked out very well for us. We're located in an incubator, which is was originally started by Southwest Michigan First Corporation and recently transferred to Western Michigan University. And that has just really worked out well for us. The facilities here, there are a lot of equipment and things that are too expensive for an individual company to buy. But nevertheless, the incubator bought them and shares them and among the residents. And so we can get access to a lot of equipment that we'd never be able to afford on our own.
And I'm thinking of the big picture, John Sorensen. How do you think that Spear and what you've been able to develop using spider venom, how do you think this could change the larger landscape of agricultural pest control really across the country?
Well, I think it will around the world, actually. One of the problems with the conventional chemical companies is that the organic synthesis and screening and all that kind of stuff has really harvested all the low fruit, if you will, and it's getting more and more and more difficult to come up with new formulas and new organic chemicals to use. And so that is the cost, therefore, of the research to find new ones is just going through the roof. And we have a platform for developing these things from spider venoms, from other venoms, scorpions and sea anemones and all kinds of things, which should provide and revitalize, really, the process of discovering new insecticides. So we're really, really excited about that, too. It's not just one product. It's a pathway to find multiple products.
And I got to imagine, I think of, for example, vaccines or when you, how cagey nature can be, keeping ahead. You know what I'm talking about, whether it's antibiotics and you get a superbug. So you can adjust what you're making and what you're developing to keep ahead of Mother Nature?
Yes, it turns out that insects and the insecticides go through the same process that bacteria and antibiotics go through. It's a constant war between the two to overcome each other. Insects go through that same process, and a lot of the traditional synthetic chemicals that we've relied on for insect control for a lot of years now, resistant insects are developing to those. We're able now to shift relatively quickly when a resistant insect appears.
John Sorensen is the director and the CEO of Vesteron. The company is based in Kalamazoo, and next year will be launching its pesticide Spear, which is a biological insecticide based on spider venom. John, thanks so much for sharing your development and your story with us on The Next Idea.
You betcha. My pleasure, and take care.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Today marks the 185th birthday of the Detroit Free Press, which began publishing on this very day in 1831 with the somewhat unwieldy name of the Democratic Free Press and Michigan Intelligencer. Michigan was still 6 years away from becoming a state, and the paper supported the drive to statehood. At age 185, the Detroit Free Press is Michigan's oldest surviving business. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Rick Snyder stepped before a crowd of 1,000 Flint residents yesterday in advance of President Obama's speech at Northwestern High School. The reaction was not warm.
You didn't create this problem. Government failed you. And I apologize, and I will work hard to fix that.
Yes, as they shouted, "You failed us." Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us now via Skype. And Daniel, as much as we've heard Governor Snyder say just what he said, "I'm working hard to fix this," you note in your columns this week, the political gamesmanship has really turned into a free-for-all. And all these months later, people are still bathing in bottled water. You can't blame them for booing, can you?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think if any of us put ourselves in that situation, we'd probably be booing too. I mean, this is failure writ large in so many ways. Although yesterday, I think, was a little, in some ways, a little less politicized than the underlying legislative gamesmanship that's going on back and forth, both in Washington and in Lansing. And everybody's got an agenda. Democrats have an agenda to make Republicans look bad. Republicans are trying to save their bacon because they know they pretty much own this. And, of course, in Washington, the EPA has got some complicity for this. Although I think, as we've discussed before, the lion's share of the blame probably is laid at the feet of the state.
And let's talk about what the grandstanding means. We've got this aid package for Flint stalled out in Congress, mainly by Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee. He says the aid package is grandstanding. In Lansing, the state Senate did approve a $128 million supplemental funding bill, but we saw three Republican senators say no, including Patrick Kolbeck of Canton, who said basically, hey, we already took care of the initial emergency at Flint. You know, what is it going to take to end that, the partisan finger pointing in the games?
Well, it's going to take some leadership, and I'm not at all convinced you're going to get it from the governor or from certainly the president, who's got 8 months left in office. There's not a lot of and he doesn't have a lot of sway with a Republican Congress. So I don't really see how that moves. And the governor, frankly, doesn't have much sway with his own Republican caucuses in the House and the Senate. They are not motivated. And we've seen this time. We're seeing it in context of the Detroit Public School bailout efforts as well. They're not really motivated to do what he's asking them to do politically. And he has not got the muscle and has not mustered the muscle to actually get them to bend to his will. Ultimately, I think there's going to be some additional public pressure that is going to get them to move. I don't think you can be in a position of authority and political leadership today in Michigan and say, you know, what's happened in Flint is really not government's problem. I think it is a basic infrastructure issue. Most people, if they're really honest, regardless of their political affiliation, would say, yeah, you know, a basic function of government is a infrastructure, and one of the most key pieces of infrastructure is, of course, public water. And they have failed. And government has a responsibility to kind of react to that. And they can foot drag and try to make these tortured explanations on talk radio, which you hear almost every other day. But it's still, you still have people of Flint 2 years later having to use bottled water to take a bath.
Meantime, the drumbeat of reckoning and accountability is getting louder and louder. Talk to us about yesterday's no contest plea by Flint Utilities Administrator Mike Glasgow. What does it all mean to the ongoing investigation?
Well, I think it signifies a couple of things. Number one is he entered a cop to a lesser charge, a one-year misdemeanor. That means he's going to cooperate with the authorities. I think the broader issue here is why we've seen many examples of government run amok, certainly in the last few, in the last 6 or 7 years, and no accountability, whether it's the IRS or Veterans Affairs, or, you know, you can go down a whole long list of things. I think what's different about this Flint water situation is that both state and federal authorities are investigating, and I think people are going to be held to account. Now, to what extent they're going to be able to make some of these charges ultimately stick and get convictions, and will anybody actually go behind bars, I think that's TBD. But I think this is clearly a situation where you're not going to see public officials walk away from this and say, oh, sorry, we made a mistake. Too bad, you lose. And I think both Barbara McQuaid, who has certainly demonstrated as the U.S. attorney in Detroit, her willingness to go after public corruption time and time and time again, this is not going to be any different. And Attorney General Bill Schuette, his chief investigator is the former FBI agent in charge, Andy Arena, who ran the Kwame Kilpatrick corruption investigation. And he, interestingly enough, when he talked about this and the initial set of charges, says, this is the biggest such case of its kind in Michigan. Mm-hmm. Now, when you think about that, of what he's been involved in, that's saying something.
And as you said in a discussion we had a week or two ago, when Andy Arena is standing there telling all the players that the train has left the station, the best seats are at the front. And you, your words were, that statement should be sending chills up and down people's spines.
Well, and the other thing they said that I think even should also send chills is nobody is excluded. Mm-hmm. And when asked pointedly whether the governor was excluded, they repeated, nobody is excluded.
Meantime, though, as you say, we see people bathing their children in the bottled water, the people in Flint. And I just can't help but think when you hear things like, hey, we took care of the emergency initially and you know, it's grandstanding. The people saying that, you know, their kids aren't bathing in bottled water.
People wonder why Donald Trump is the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party. Mm. This is one reason. I mean, I think there is such a disconnect in so many levels of government between the people out there who are paying the bills, trying to raise their family, go to work each day, and the people that they've elected. To your point, if this was happening in some of these other communities, would people be more outraged? Certainly the people who represent those communities would be more outraged. And I think that's the problem. There's a real lack of empathy here, number one. And secondly, the ideology in these kind of questions always simmers right below the surface. Sometimes it's at the surface, but it's certainly right below the surface. And you push them a little bit, and there's always going to be constituents that are going to be complaining, and they're going to load their commentary with racial things in a city like Flint, or you're seeing it in Detroit in terms of the DPS bailout. Why do we have to pay for those cities? Those cities have been run by Democrats for 50 years. I mean, I've heard it all, mm-hmm. and you've probably heard it all. Mm-hmm. And it's a continuing theme, and I think it animates this legislature, whether they like to admit it or not, and it's a pretty ugly side of the legislature.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
How far should police agencies go in monitoring social media in the name of protecting public officials? The question was raised in the light of recent emails released by Governor Snyder's office. An email indicated the Michigan State Police knew that a Copper City man made a potentially threatening Facebook post against the governor over the Flint water crisis. The Flint Journal reports an MSP senior intelligence analyst alerted commanders about the post. And the man who wrote the post was on probation after he'd been involved in a 12-hour armed standoff with police. There was an effort to charge this man with violating probation, but a judge ultimately decided not to move ahead with that. Rachel Levinson-Weldman is senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. She's an expert in areas of security, privacy, and surveillance. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Now, we are all very well aware that security agencies and police are monitoring social media for national security, for terrorist activity. And should we be surprised to learn state police intelligence analysts are checking our social media posts for state and local concerns?
Well, I think maybe we should be surprised and maybe a little disappointed. You know, you take this case here, you know, clearly this post is kind of a matter of some concern. There's a potential threat. At the same time, you think, what is the time that's being spent monitoring social media and for what benefit? It certainly can't be a surprise that people were upset about the water situation in Flint. And I think the concern is that you may spend a lot of time monitoring social media, monitoring constitutionally protected activity, whether that's simply communicating, whether that's saying, oh, you know, we're going to meet for a protest at such and such time. You may chill a lot of that activity for not much of any benefit.
Just to get everybody on the same page, I'm going to read this Facebook post in question. Here is the exact quote. It's time for civil unrest. Burn down the governor mansion. Eliminate the Capitol, where the legislators reinstated the emergency dictator law after the people voted it down, and tell the Mish state police if they use military force, we will return with same. End quote. So this was according to the state police email that was released by the governor's office. So, Rachel, where's the line between stepping on First Amendment rights of free speech and prudently monitoring threats against public officials?
Right. This is the kind of statement where I can understand why, if somebody had come across this, especially given his history, they would think this is somewhat concerning. At the same time, what we're talking about here isn't even just coming across this. It is an entire program to monitor social media, presumably Facebook, where this was from, to monitor presumably Twitter, maybe other sort of social media platforms. And it was done not only through the Michigan State Police, but the affiliation between the state police and the local Fusion Center, which is a much broader center that brings sort of a variety of intelligence operations to bear. Fusion centers do not have a good history of respecting civil liberties, of making good judgments in terms of the reports that they develop, how they share that information. So I think it's a matter of a lot of concern that even if they do occasionally hit gold, that there's an entire program dedicated to monitoring what are likely to be mostly fairly innocuous posts.
Tell us more about the Fusion Center, because I don't think most of us are aware of those and what they are and who runs them.
Fusion centers, they're all around the country. They basically grew out of sort of post-September 11th analysis. The question was, what allowed all of this information about the planning of the 9/11 attacks to fall through the cracks? Part of the answer was simply information sharing. There was a lot of information that had been gathered but hadn't been shared appropriately. So these fusion centers were started up. They're all over the country. And the idea is to bring a whole bunch of different stakeholders literally to one physical place to kind of monitor and to share information. So you have local, state, federal law enforcement. You have intelligence divisions. You have often private industry that are involved. There's big companies in the area, things like that, which in some ways sounds like a great idea. It makes some sense to be sharing information among those different groups and stakeholders. What they have actually managed to accomplish, though, falls far short of what that sounds like. So in fact, they have produced very little of value. They were originally started for counterterrorism purposes, but frankly, there isn't enough counterterrorism work to keep them busy. And so most of them have expanded to sort of this all hazards model where maybe they're helping to, you know, track down petty drug crime, things like that. And they have a history of often releasing reports that in fact relate to constitutionally protected activity. So they have not contributed much in the way of what they were originally set up to do.
I will note that the Flint Journal report notes that this senior intelligence agency is with the state police, and people are now aware that there is an intelligence commander. And I think that is probably something that has not occurred to people who tend to think of state police in traditional police work. I also have to ask, how does this post, the one I just read, how do you think that differs from that very widely publicized tweet from Cher last January when the Flint story became a national story? And I will read the one in particular that got a lot of attention. WTF is going on with power-mad, greed-driven, killer, incompetent politicians. They are criminals. Governor Rick Snyder of Michigan, hashtag firing squad works for me. Now, would that firing squad hashtag be justified in catching police attention?
That's one of the concerns about having police, having law enforcement involved in social media monitoring, because there's going to be a lot of judgment calls to make, right? Is there some post that kind of raises red flags, other ones that don't? When those red flags are raised, what happens? What's the next step? I think one of the concerns here is it seems more likely that this kind of online surveillance is going to play out in the same way that a lot of on-the-ground surveillance does, which is that it tends to be targeted more at members of racial and ethnic minorities, of kind of lower socioeconomic communities, just the same way that we tend to see over-policing or disproportionate policing in minority neighborhoods. Certainly we're seeing with police departments that are very heavily involved in social media monitoring, so to take the New York Police Department as an example, a lot of that tends to be focused quite significantly on essentially Black and Latino men. There are going to be a lot of judgment calls to be made if an officer or an intelligence officer sees a post, thinking not only what are the words there, but who's making that statement. So in one of the examples, you know, there's somebody who actually has a criminal history, was involved in a standoff with police. Mm-hmm. There may be other circumstances where an analyst is just making a judgment on the basis of what they see in somebody's picture or what they see in somebody's bio. And that's a matter of real concern. And this is separate from whether somebody has actually taken actual steps in furtherance, right? This is ultimately words.
That's true. And we should note that the Copper City man who wrote that post about the governor, as we noticed, he'd been sentenced to 2 years probation because of the armed standoff, pleading no contest to attempted felonious assault. There were some other counts that were dismissed at the time that police were trying to pursue, including threats of terrorism, because police say he had made threats against a number of local authorities, apparently in connection with disconnecting his water over an unpaid bill. So if you're looking at that and making that judgment call, clearly that was not the case with Cher. She was using her First Amendment rights.
Right. And I will say the fact that there were counts of terrorism that had been dropped, but that word terrorism was invoked with respect to threats against local officials related to cutting off his water bill, I do not in any way sanction threats against local officials. But the fact that terrorism is used, that was sort of a basis for potential charges, I think also shows, you know, it's one thing to say, well, we're monitoring for the purposes of counterterrorism, for finding terrorist threats. That term is used pretty broadly, and it can encompass a whole lot of things.
And can that then spill over to people making posts on whatever the scandal du jour is? Is that where you could see this going?
Sure. I think that's a concern that, you know, anything that comes up, you know, especially in an age of sort of increasing social media is a very active place for discussion, for learning about issues, for organizing. And if there's kind of a social media flurry, in some ways, it's an easy place for law enforcement to follow. They can use keywords and say, oh, what are people saying about this? But ultimately, a lot of what they're doing is following speech, following communication, to the extent that there is even organizing or planning, a lot of that is going to be constitutionally protected.
There's a balance that has to be struck. And I'm thinking of, for example, school shootings, when then people go back and go, oh my God, look what he was putting on Facebook. Gee, no one did anything. So how do you balance that with, you know, the risk that public officials take that someone could do that versus, you know, constitutional rights?
It is a tough balancing act, and I think that's a great question. And I don't think that we have the precise balancing mechanism yet. There are a couple of broad principles to keep in mind. So one is whatever monitoring that's going on as protective as possible of constitutional rights, of the ability to speak freely, to organize, to sort of not be chilled by the fear that police are going to show up at your door, going to do more searches based on constitutionally protected activity, and also having transparency to the extent that there is a policy in place for how law enforcement is doing that.
Rachel Levinson-Weldman is senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law, where she specializes in security, privacy, and surveillance. It was great to talk with you, Rachel. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside was engineered today by Peg Watson. Our contributors are Allie Billings, Cass Adair, Mike Blank, Tony Brown, Ryan Grimes, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.